We continue the shiur in Sichah Yisaran, Sif Kuf Memtes, dealing with the Sipuri Maisias. Benazal stories were in the middle of the 13th last story in Sipuri Maisias called the Zion Bettlers, and the story pertaining to or dealing with this young couple who, after their wedding, during the 7 days, Shivas Yimei HaMishta, after their wedding, had this kisufim, this yearning, this craving for the sight again of the seven betlers, seven beggars who had fed them when they were small children. Because of their kisufim, because of their strong desire for Kedusha, for these tzaddikim, therefore, desire is what drew them, brought them to them, and each one of these seven betlers, who at first appeared to be to possess a physical defect, demonstrated the fact that he was perfect physically. It was only an illusion about this defect. In fact, each one possessed supernatural powers. And these supernatural powers, they now gave as a gift to this couple. And these seven betlers, of course, are really the tzaddikemis, who possesses the qualities of all seven. He demonstrates these qualities one each day. All, of course, obviously leading up to the end of the Golus, leading up to the Geula Shleima for the Jews. Now, to recap slightly, we're in the middle of the fifth day, when the fifth Betler showed up. The fifth Betler was the one with the apparent hunchback. His shoulders were hunched. He explained that truly, actually, his shoulders were not hunched. He has very broad and powerful shoulders. The fact that he carries a lot, he carries more than anyone on his shoulders. His shoulders are the bechina, the category of a miut, machzik es hamruba. Little area that can contain a lot of mass on this small area. Here we explain, a story explains about the different levels of Kedusha. The higher the Kedusha, the smaller the area, the more it can contain. As we said, physically, scientifically, it seems to be proven that every amount of area can contain only that much space within the area. In fact, when we go to Kedusha, spiritual, we find that there is no limit. It is not bound by the laws of space any longer. Could contain more, as for example, in Eretz Yisrael, the Beis HaMikdash, where in a small area you had all the entire nation of Jews could fit in comfortably, defying all the laws of space. Now in this story, the Chachamim, the wise men, who were speaking to this Betler, each boasted about his powers of Miyat Machzik Samaruba, how he was able to surpass, go beyond this law of space, until finally the Betler spoke up and said, I am higher, greater than all of you. My degree of Miyat Machzik Samaruba is greater than all of yours, because I'm completely above the entire Indian of Mokam space, Amalam and Mokam completely. He proceeded to prove it by the discussion of a special group of tzaddikim who delved into the issue of, can there be found a tree under which all the animals can assemble under the shade of the branches of that tree, and whose branches and boughs and twigs all the birds of the world too can settle and live there peacefully. They discovered there is such a tree. As we said, this is the special tree in Gan Eden, the Eitz HaChayim, which means the tree which stands for the Torah Kedusha. But to get to it, the problem is first how to find the correct route to get there. Then, when you do find it, you discover the tree, how to get to the tree actually. So the Betler said to these wise men, now that you know about this tree, how do you intend to get there? And a debate arose Some said we go to the correct direction is to go to the east. Some said to the west. Others said different directions. This, of course, is a debate among the Chachamim, Tzaddikim, just as we have in the Gemara. They could not get together. They could not find a common denominator among them. Until a wise one spoke up and said, why do you discuss the question of how to get to the tree? First, find out who is fit to arrive there. Because, as a rule, there is a rule, established set rule, that the only person that can get to that tree is the one that possesses the qualities of that tree itself. The tree itself has three roots besides the trunk itself. This is the part we were up to, discussing the qualities of this tree. The three roots of the tree, first root is emuna, faith. Second root is yira, that's fear of Hashem. The third root is anivus, that's humbleness. The tree's trunk is emes, truth. And from this tree comes forth branches, other midas, other good qualities. And therefore, it's impossible for anyone to get to this tree unless he possesses these qualities. Now, these four items, speaking about a tree, right, of course, this represents something much higher. We speak about, Zayde Kodesh speaks about the Sheroshe de Lona, this special tree. We say three roots, plus the trunk. Trunk of the tree, which is Emes, that obviously refers to Yaakov Avinu. We speak about these three plus one. It is the Gimel Ovais, the Meshe Rabbeinu. Three fathers of the Jews, and Meshe Rabbeinu, and simply, as is known, Avraham Avinu was the first of the roots, Emuna. Avraham Avinu, Avraham HaIvri, he was on one side of the world against the opposed, the entire world. The entire world was filled with atheism and Avodah Zarah. He stood steadfastly, a powerful root, the foundation of Emunah, Yisayd Emunah. He spread Emunah to the entire world. So that root stands for, that Shedesh stands for, the first of the Oveis HaKadoshim, Avraham Avinu. The second Yira is Pachad Yitzchak. Pachad Yitzchak, that's Yira, Chesed and Givura, that's Emuna and Yira. Second one is Yitzchak Avinu. Third root is Anivus, humbleness, that is Meshe Rabbeinu. The Guf, the body of the tree itself, is Emes. Generally, we always speak about the three roots as the Gimel Avos. Here we note that the Guf HaIlon, body of the trunk of the tree, is Emes, and this Emes is the Mida of Yaakov Avinu. So the trunk, which means that even Meshe Rabbeinu was born from Yaakov Avinu. He too came from Yaakov Avinu. The trunk itself, which gave birth to all the Jews, all B'nai Yisrael, Meshe Rabbeinu too is part of B'nai Yisrael. Midos that come from Meshe Rabbeinu, that Mida itself is unique. No one is classified as the true honor of all time as much as Meshe Rabbeinu. Therefore, these are the four qualities that a tzaddik is supposed to possess before he can get to this special tree, the tree of the Eitz HaChayim, the tree of life, which means the Torah itself. If one wants to delve into the secrets of the Torah and take and draw life from it, spiritual life, he must have first these special qualities. He must purify himself to this point. Therefore, they had to search among themselves, find one or more who possessed these qualities that could get to the tree. In searching, you found that certain ones did have it, some did not. But this group of Chachamim had such a strong degree of achdus, unity among themselves, they refused to divide the group, to separate, that some should go and some should remain. This they turned down, because not all were fit to go. So they decided upon a solution. The solution was that they would all delay the trip. They would wait until every one of them had perfected himself and all possessed these four qualities. They would work on purifying themselves through tefillah, through fasting, through depriving themselves, deprivation, but they would perfect themselves till they had these four necessary midos to get to this tree so that they could go together be achdus. This they did. They struggled very hard in the Avedis Hashem until they arrived at these midos. Then when they arrived at the midos, suddenly they said, now let's see which way to go. And here they realized they all agreed upon the correct path. No longer was there a difference of opinion to go the east, west, or other directions. Now they suddenly found, they all felt the correct direction was the real right one. So, agreeing, they all went on this path to the tree. This is what the Gemara says. We learned it in Sanhedrin. The Gemara says that when there is ahava, when there is true affection between people, between, let us say, a couple, a husband and wife, and they are poor, they don't have money to buy an expensive set of colonial furniture, or Louis XIV bedroom, or $5,000 oak paneled beds with double headboards lined with gold tassels. All they could do, they couldn't even get two beds. They tried to get one bed, they couldn't afford it either. So they finally found that they could get a knife, a sword. And this sword, the side was so rusty, they had to stand the sword up on its side with a sharp edge upward. And a very sharp edge it was. This very sharp edge, like a hair breadth of width, the couple proceeded to live, to use that as a bed, to sleep on that bed. The Gemara says when the ahava was great between this couple, they didn't mind it. They found that it was a very comfortable bed, because the ahava itself, the affection, the sincerity in them, made them disregard the discomfort. They were comfortable. There was enough space. Of course, this is an allegory. Whether we could say seriously sleeping on the sharp edge of a sword, take it literally or not, the Gemara uses that to demonstrate the point that space means nothing when it comes to, or comfort means nothing if two people live together in peace, in harmony, mutual respect. They don't mind the surroundings. They don't mind the difficulty and the type of home they have. Whereas, if there is no peace, if there's dissension, disharmony between this couple, they'll find that they'll buy a very special, a super king-size bed, 60 yards wide. And this 60-yard wide bed, they'll find, is too narrow for them. They just can't get along. They need more space than that because they're not homogeneous. They can't be together in peace. So they need more space than this 60 yards. Is that possible that a bed 60 yards wide is not enough to house two people for a night? Is that logical? The answer is very much so. We've seen a case, an actual case. We've seen a case of two brothers, Cain and Hevel, who were the only two people in the world to inherit the whole world. It was a very large globe. Very large world, a lot of forests, a lot of vegetation, a lot of animals. To divide a large world like this, this whole globe between two people, that's surely enough to last them for quite a while. And as the Midrash says, Mefedesh, Cain said to Hevel, this world is not big enough for both of us. One has got to go. Not big enough. Millions of people live in peace. Small areas. That's when there is unity. When there is disharmony, disunity, and no space is large enough to house two people with diversionary opinions. So, because the Chachamim now had arrived at a point of pure achdus, it was no longer a question of direction. They all were together. They found the right path because of this achdus. As the Gemara says that Hashem himself wants achdus among people so much, and he's willing to overlook their shortcomings. Difference between the Deir HaFloga and the Anshei Sidon. Deir HaFloga, who built the Tower of Babel, because they did not have unity among them, what happened? Hashem said, let them go. They've got to be destroyed, separated, break them up. So they were sent throughout the entire world. Different countries became inhabited, settled. Because they did not have peace among themselves, Hashem didn't want them. But where there was peace among themselves, they lived together. They themselves, they committed crimes, true, but among themselves they were at peace, so their crimes were overlooked. Very bad against Hashem. Their crimes were overlooked until they committed foul crimes against humans. Then they had to pay for their crimes. But as far as going against Hashem, even with the Avodah Zarah, as long as there was unity, then their sentence was a light one. So we see that Achdus is a very vital point. Of course, Achdus among Tzaddikim is most vital. If the Jews would have Achdus, unity, even if they weren't that perfect or that pure, then surely Mashiach would come. Of course, we cannot say it's the fault of the Orthodox minority that there's no Achdus, as the Reformed claim. They are in the majority. Why don't we have Achdus? Let the Orthodox give in to the Reform, as we show them, and we'll all be one. Achdus will have Mashiach. That's the question the Gemara asks about why, if we consider majority rule, and why not? Why should the Jews, Chas v'Shalom, surrender to the Goyim? Surrender, give up their religion, live like Goyim, if majority rules? The answer is majority rules only where there is something concrete, where there is truth, but not where there is something that is false, meaningless, completely meaningless and worthless. Since the faith of Goyim is actually worthless, worth less than nothing, of course, and then surely you cannot expect truth to give in, to succumb, become subdued to falsehood. The only majority is that of truth, and therefore, in fact, the Jews today are in the majority in the world. When it comes to truth, they are in the majority. But back to the story, this group set out. They went for a period of time until they could see the tree from far. They actually observed this tree. The marvel of this tree. A tree which could hold all the animals of the world, all the birds of the world, in peace. There'd be actual peace there. But they were amazed when they looked at this tree and saw that the tree is there, but it's not there. It's in a place where there is no place. The tree was in no place. There was no space at all. How do we describe spacelessness? Fact was that there was not 1 inch of space, and yet in that zero amount of space, there the tree stood spread out with all its branches and with the vast amount that it could take. Now, since the tree is not in a place, it's not in a actual space, how do you get to spacelessness? How do you go from space to to a place where there is no space. All these wise men were now in a quandary. They could not solve this dilemma. Now this Betla, this apparent hunchback Betla, spoke up and said, I was there too. I said to them, I can bring you all, I can carry you all to this tree. On my shoulders, the Pasuk says, Yisochor Tzadikim, as it says, Vayet Shichma Lisbel. He bent his shoulders to carry the burden of the Torah. What is great about carrying that burden? Because, as we know, speaking about the degrees of spacelessness, we spoke about Eretz Yisrael, the 10 levels of Kedusha, how in Eretz Yisrael you could fit unlimited, infinite number of people, how in Yerushalayim all the Jews could assemble and find place to sleep comfortably, how in the yard of the Beis HaMikdash, the entire Jewish population could assemble there and bow with space to spare. Now, still further, going into the Holy of Holies, the Holy Ark was in a room, this Holy of Holies, between the two angelic figures, between the two Kruvim. The Kruvim, side by side, filled up exactly the width of that room. Completely filled up the width of that room. Right between these two Kruvim, how much space was there between the two Kruvim? Zero. There wasn't a fraction of an inch of space because it was exactly the amount to fill up the room. In between those two Kruvim, which means with zero space, that's where the Holy Ark stood. How do you fit a Holy Ark into a space of zero? That's because it was so holy that it was above the concept of space, the Malam and Amokim. It was that great and that holy, it was not ruled by the laws of space. This was the case of this Tzadik Emes. What is the fact of this Oren Kodesh? The Gemara says that it was carried in the desert by the Levim. Levim carried the Oren Kodesh as the Jews moved through the desert. Now they carried it on their shoulders. Did the Levim physically carry the Oren Kodesh? The Oren Kodesh is that holy and that great above nature, could it be carried by physical beings? The Gemara says that it looked as though they were carrying the Oren Kodesh. Actually, if you observed closely, you would see that the feet of the Levim did not touch the ground. So the Oren is Nisei Es Nisov. The Oren really, literally carried its carriers. At no time was the Oren carried through the desert. The Oren was on their shoulders, but the Oren moved, carrying, holding up, elevating those who were supposed to be carrying it. This is what this Betla said. Since I am above the concept of space, the Tzadik Emes, I am like the Oren Kodesh, therefore I can take all of you, carry you into this place that is above the concept of space, where this tree, the special tree is. So this he proceeded to do. And of course, with this he proved that he had unusual shoulders. He was not a hunchback after all. His shoulders were more powerful than any in existence. The reason that they seemed hunched was because he kept them hunched away from the physical, material, mundane items in this world. He refused to associate with anything that was base, crass, and Gashmius. But in truth he was the Tzadik Emes, who was the Malam and Hamokim, and possessed the true essence of Biyat Machzik V'Samruva. Now he said to this couple, now that I am here on this fifth day, I give you this power as a gift, that you should be like I am. And great joy broke out. They were very happy. They rejoiced that day tremendously with this fifth battle. The next day, the sixth day after the celebration, this wedding feast, they were also very happy, and they began to yearn for the sixth betla, betla without hands, without arms. They began to cry, how can we get this betla here? Because they yearned and cried, as usual, by crying and yearning for Kedusha, the person in Zecha to it, suddenly he appeared. And he said, I am here. You want me that badly, that strongly, that intensely? I am here for your sake. I've come to you at this wedding. And he said to them, again, you think, it appears to you that I have a physical defect, my hands and my arms. Fact is that there's nothing wrong with my arms at all. Truth is that I have a power, full power in my hands, but I do not use this power at all in this physical world. I need this for a different purpose, and I'm preserving the power of my hands specifically for that purpose. What that purpose is, we'll see. He said, yes, I have a confirmation about this power of mine, that my hands are superior in power to any hands that exist. This will be confirmed by the fortress made of pure, crystal clear water. A fortress of water. How does a fortress of water stand up? And of course, they were amazed, and he proceeded to tell them the story. This is the last story told by the Ben Azal. This is the most amazing of all the stories. This is the one about which there is more depth, a greater revelation of the heavenly secrets than any other part, any of the other stories. About this, Ben Azal said that this story is so deep, as much as we can derive from it, we must wait for Mashiach to come. Mashiach will then give us the secrets of this story. Plus, of course, the end of the story, which we lack. Now, this sixth Betla said, he told this story. One time, we were sitting together, a number of people. In this case, of course, people refers to very great tzaddikim. Who these great tzaddikim are is difficult to say. But of course it means the great tzaddikim of the past, the greatest tzaddikim of all time, or above the physical. Those are Bali. This was a group of the greatest tzaddikim. Each one spoke about the power that he has in his hands. Special powers. One said that he has one kind of a power. Second said a different kind of a power. Each one had a different type of power. Now, the first one said, he prided himself that he has such a strength and power in his hands that when he shoots an arrow, when he shoots the arrow, he has the power of drawing the arrow back to himself. Without moving, he can get the arrow back to where it came from. He has that type of power. Though he shot this arrow already, he could still retrieve this arrow. It's a tremendous power. We find that as a pasuk, Hashem said to Eiv, and Hashem spoke to Eiv. Eiv was suffering. Eiv complained to Hashem. Hashem said to Eiv, do you know what it means to be able to shoot an arrow and retrieve it? So we see this is one of the items mentioned in the Torah, where Hashem himself spoke about this power. Now, if a tzaddik says he has this power, we would think that that should just about finish the contest. But the Betler, this sixth Betler spoke up, who was there and said, he asked this first tzaddik, you can retrieve the arrow, right? Tell me, which kind of an arrow is it that you can retrieve? Because in fact, there are 10 different types of arrows. What's meant by an arrow? What is meant by 10 different kinds of arrows? An arrow is used in warfare. An arrow itself does not necessarily kill. What is done generally is to smear the arrow with a special type of poison. Now, there are 10 different kinds of poison. No one wants to shoot these arrows. He smears the arrow with a certain type of poison, any one of these 10. And when this is done, and of course, the different kind of harm comes from it. Most cases, of course, it is fatal. Some cases it can bring insanity, or it can bring a certain type of a physical defect. These 10 different types of poisons, one is worse than the other, one does more harm than the other. This is what's meant by 10 different kinds of arrows. Because actually, all arrows are the same. It's just that they differ because of the different types of poison that are smeared on them. So now, he asked, which kind of arrow is it that you can retrieve? First question. Second question, he asked, you retrieve the arrow after you've shot it out of your bow, but before it hit the victim, or can you even retrieve it after it hit the victim? After it penetrated the victim, can you retrieve it then too? Retrieve it meaning that to draw back with the poison from the victim, it shouldn't do any harm. This tzaddik answered, I can retrieve the arrow even after it struck and reached its mark. I can still retrieve that. But you asked, what kind of arrow? One certain type of arrow. That's my ability. The Bettler replied, if that's the case, if you can retrieve only one kind of arrow, then you are not fit, you are not able to cure the princess. Because you can only draw out one of these 10 arrows, it is impossible for you to serve as the one to cure the princess, whose fate we'll learn in a moment. Of course, first, Nosazel says we have to understand what is the sense. We're speaking now not about an enemy. We're speaking now about a tzaddik. Why would a tzaddik shoot a poison arrow and then retrieve it? He retrieves the arrow, it's a great accomplishment. Why shoot the arrow in the first place? Do you want to cure somebody? Do you cure him by shooting a poison arrow into him? The answer is that we're speaking about one who has already been harmed by this type of arrow or arrows. In order to cure that person, the cure is by shooting a second arrow with this poison, retrieving it, and this poison will draw its own kind. By drawing out his own arrow, it will also draw out the poison that was embedded by the other, the arrows of the enemy. This, of course, means the person was struck by the Gezeda, decrees of the, through the Satan, through the Angel of Death, through the Baldovar, and because of sins which merited it. What does the tzaddik emes do? In order to be mamtik this din, to subdue, to nullify this din, he's got to be mamtik the din bisholoshoi. In the very origin, the root of this din, he's got to descend to that root, and right there in the root itself, to clear it out, to clean out the roots. And this he does, proceeds to by going to, he attacks this root with din itself. So it means he uses a poison arrow to reach the very root of that din, and with this, he draws his own arrow out, drawing with it all the rest of the poison of that din, which was injected by the Gzar Din from heaven through the Sotah. This is why this tzaddik said, even after I strike the victim with this poison, I can still withdraw it. Withdraw it and remove the poison that comes from the Satan. This was the first tzaddik who spoke up. Second tzaddik said, I have a power in my hands that from whoever I take, I actually give. My taking is not really taking, it is giving. Which means, of course, this is the power of tzedakah. The Gemara says that what the poor person does for the rich man is much more than what the rich man does for the poor man. By taking from the rich man tzedakah, he's doing the rich man a favor. Because in turn, the rich man is going to receive much more than he gave. So receive dividends for the tzedakah he gives, that is so much, he'll get back more than he gave, so the giving is really receiving. This therefore means tzedakah. The Bettler asked him, what kind of stucco, since you are a Baal stucco, what kind of stucco do you give? He goes, actually, there are 10 kinds of stucco. And the tzaddik answered, I give a certain stucco called Meiser, which means, essence, one of the 10. Esser, I give one of these 10, I'm a master of one of these 10 degrees of stucco. The Bettler replied, if that's the case, you cannot cure the princess. You cannot even get to where she is, because she is behind 10 walls. And you can only get through to one. One wall alone is not enough. Since you cannot get to where she is, then you surely cannot cure her. So in this case, your power is futile. The next one, the third one, spoke up and said, I have a power of my hands. There are certain officials, high officers in this world. This means there are leaders politically over cities or lands. Every leader, in order to be able to rule, must have wisdom. Each person to rule requires a special kind of wisdom. He said, I have power in my hands that I can endow a person with wisdom through my hands. It is like the union of smicha. A person gets a rabbinical degree, we call that smicha. The samach es yoda olav. Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, place your hands upon Yeshua. Give him smicha. Rest your hands upon him and thereby endow him with this gift of wisdom. So this tzaddik said, I have the power in my hands to place my hands upon a person and thereby bless him, give him a degree of wisdom. The Bettler asked him, which kind of wisdom can you bestow upon this person? Because there are 10 degrees of wisdom. The Gemara says, when Hashem created the world, there were 10 measures of chokhmah given to the world. Of these 10 measures, which of these measures can you give to the person that you're giving the smicha to, this chokhmah to? The tzaddik answered, I can give this one certain type of chokhmah. The Bettler said to him again, if that's the case, you too cannot cure the princess, because you cannot recognize, you cannot detect, you cannot read a pulse. The pulse is the barometer of the physical quality of the body, the condition of the body. A person, a doctor can tell the condition of a person by feeling his pulse. And in order to know the pulse, you have to have a knowledge of these 10 kinds of wisdom. Since you know only one type of pulse, there are 10 different pulses, then you cannot cure this princess. The Tikkun Zayah goes into this very much in depth. We'll discuss it a little later, more in detail. What is meant by reading a pulse? How does one read a pulse? How does one detect the feel of a pulse? It would seem to us that they're all about the same. All pulses sound the same. One may be stronger, one weaker. But how do you read this pulse? How do you tell the condition of the person, actually, not just physically, spiritually? How do you read the neshama? By feeling the pulse. What is meant by knowing all 10 kinds of pulses? In any event, the Bettler said to this tzaddik, you're great, you know one of these 10. In order to cure the princess, you must have all 10. Because we're speaking here, as we'll see, about a princess who needs all 10 cures. She was struck with all 10 arrows and must have one super person, a tzaddik who has the ability of all 10 to be able to cure her. Since you know only one pulse, you cannot be the one to cure. The fourth and last one spoke up and said, I have a power in my hands. My power is that when there is a storm wind, powerful gale or a hurricane, I can put my hands up and stop that storm in its tracks. I can also control this storm wind to a point I can abate it, weaken it, subdue it, where it should move at its proper speed, I can command it to go at a certain special speed. Butler asked him, which kind of wind can you control with your hands? There are 10 different kinds of winds, 10 different types of winds. Of course, there are 4 directions. Besides this, that's 4 directions of winds, north wind, south, as the Gemara describes. But basically, there are 10 different kinds of winds. You are the master of which one? One or ones? The Tzaddik replied, one kind, this certain kind of wind. The Betler said to him, if that's the case, then you too cannot cure the princess, because when we speak of winds, on a much higher level, we speak of the wisdom of music, the wind instruments that produce musical notes. And the holiest of all sounds are these musical notes, as we see in the Sefer Teda, as we'll explain to later. The highest of all elements in existence is the musical sound. Now, there are 10 kinds of sounds, 10 kinds of musical sounds, basically. And these are produced by the 10 types of blowing power of these winds. In order to know the 10 kinds of negina, just as, for example, the Tikkunot Chloe is composed of the 10 chapters of Tillim, 10 kinds of negina that come from these 10 kinds of winds. Therefore, in order to be able to use this, to achieve this, you must know every one of these 10. Without this, without the knowledge of these 10 kinds of negina, you do not have the cure for the princess. Since you know only one, then you can't be the one to cure. These 4 tzaddikim turned to the Betler, this Betler without hands, and said to him, we told you what we can do. You criticized us. Tell us, what's your power? What power do you have in your hands? This Betler replied, I can do what you can do, which means each one of you has a power with one kind of poison arrows, or one kind of stucco, or one kind of wisdom, or one kind of wind. I can do that. But I also know the other 9/10 of each one of you. I'm perfect in all 10 parts of these 4 items. I can do completely what you failed to do. And he said, now, I'll tell you, I'll reveal the story behind all this, why it is so necessary to know about this. What is the special story of the princess who needs a cure? Began to tell this story about a certain king who had a strong desire, a yearning for this princess. Princess who possessed the greatest beauty on earth in existence. He strove with all types of schemes to capture this princess. He did everything, used every wile and scheme possible, until he finally succeeded in capturing this princess. Now, in essence, of course, this story deals with the Yetzer Hara, the Satan, who's dedicated to his work capturing, taking captive, the most beautiful item in existence. The princess is the neshama. Every Jewish neshama is called a princess. It comes from heaven, Father in heaven, born from, the neshama is born from the Yichud Li'ela, the king and queen of heaven. And this princess is the desire of the Satan to capture, to take captive this princess for himself. That is the greatest victory on the part of the Satan. Chas v'shalom, overpower the spiritual beauty, the Kedusha of a Jew's neshama. Or, more so, to try to take captive the Knesset Yisrael, the one general neshama of the entire Jewish people, as was the work of the Satan at one time, Pare. Pare who tried to enslave all the Jews in his land to remove them from their religion. Or the king of Yavon, the time of the Jews in the Beis HaMikdash, time of Hanukkah, to get them to leave, to desert their religion, to become captive to him, who was Svalakli, then the Satan. This is the work of the Satan, and the time came, he said, when the princess was captured. However, there began an incident which changed the picture radically. This incident is what brought about the entire story of this Bedlam. This will take up in the next shiur, and we'll attempt to interpret as much as possible all these items we spoke about. Now, every one of these is extremely rich. It deals with a very deep topic and would pay for each person to honestly and truly concentrate very deeply with a very deep topic and would pay